Drug overdoses kill more than 100,000 Americans a year. That's the most recent CDC data. Just put that 100,000 number in perspective for a moment. It's more than if you total up the number of car fatalities and gun-related deaths in a year. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We look for treatment solutions, how to tackle this crisis with a focus on supervised injection sites. Have you or a loved one suffered from drug addiction? What was your experience like? Who or what program helped you through it? 800-642-1234. Sharon Larson is Associate Dean of Research at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, also Executive Director of the Mainline Health Center for Population Health Research at Lankanaw Institute for Medical Research. Sharon, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can we take stock for just a moment? How bad, in your eyes, is the opioid epidemic? And will it worsen from where we're at now?
Well, unless we learn how to do some things differently, I think it will continue to increase. Unfortunately, during the pandemic, we've turned our attention away. We've had fewer treatment opportunities, and so I think we have to focus on this. And, you know, I think it's a big deal. When you have 100,000 people or more dying, then you have to start thinking about some innovations to the way that we've been doing things.
Well, let's look at one of those perhaps innovations. Can you explain that, you know, there are efforts around the country to establish these safe consumption sites for drugs, including in Philadelphia, where you are. Can you explain what the theory is behind providing people a safe place to inject illicit drugs?
So, great question, Kate. We know that there have been no sanctioned or legally authorized safe consumption facilities or safe injection sites among the many names that we have for these. And now we have New York. These have been up and operating for many years in other countries, and they vary in the kinds of services that they offer. Some serve as little more than a needle exchange opportunity, which obviously improves rate of infections that occur as the result of using dirty needles. Some provide opportunities for taking a shower. Others provide healthcare professionals who can make sure that those who use drugs by injection are properly injecting, are injecting in a clean way, are not using dirty needles. And some of these, many more of these today probably than have been in the past, are also opening doors for both medical care and substance use treatment.
You mentioned needle exchange. In Philadelphia, that you were an early leader in syringe exchange in the early 90s in the HIV-AIDS crisis, which really helped to dramatically bring down transmission of HIV. And I'm wondering, do you see a parallel? Do you see a parallel with syringe exchange programs as to what could happen with supervised injection sites?
Right. So we actually conducted a study a few years ago to examine what would happen if a safe injection site were located in Philadelphia. And we did this in partnership with the City of Philadelphia Health Department. And what we found was that if the models, I want to just say, we have no data to tell us what happens when we use safe injection facilities or safe consumption facilities. But the models suggest that we might save as many as 75 or 76 lives in a given year. That's pretty significant in a city that lost 1,200 to opioid and other kinds of drug overdoses in 2020 and in 2021. So 75, 76 lives. We also found that there was a nearly $2 million savings in reducing soft tissue injury that occurs when we use needles over and over and over again. So if we can reduce those soft tissue injuries, we have fewer people being hospitalized, and that's a cost savings to the health system and to the city when the city bears the brunt of that. I don't know if you're aware of this, but these hospitalizations that occur purely from soft tissue injury often lead to hospitalizations of 6 to 7 days.
Wow.
Which is a long time today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Very costly as well. I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment. Sharon Larson, Associate Dean of Research at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, as we learn about the concept of overdose prevention centers, what Sharon's research has looked at in helping combat the opioid epidemic. You can join in. What do you think about the idea of allowing people to use drugs in safe, supervised environments? Is it a good or bad idea to introduce in American cities? 800-642-1234. Sharon, in Philadelphia, it has explored opening this, you know, a sanctioned drug use site. What has been the response in the community?
So, Kate, that's not an area that I spend a lot of time working in, but I would say that there was a site selected. There was a plan to open a facility, and there was considerable community pushback in a way that caused the city to rethink location. And during that time, there was some federal pushback because of the way that federal regulations are written around these kinds of issues. And while the federal regulations don't specifically touch on safe consumption facilities, they do focus on sort of regulatory control over places that might encourage the use of drugs.
Yeah, because some people might worry that if you sanction a place where people can do drugs, that that might encourage drug use, especially among youth. And opponents also say, like, such facilities may actually lessen the incentive for users to enter treatment and recovery. Is this a challenge? Is this a barrier?
Well, it certainly is in, does it increase drugs? Drug use is the first question. And mm-hmm. I would say we don't think so. In other countries where safe consumption facilities have been introduced, there does not appear to be an increase in drug use in those places. And there appears to be an increase in the number of people who go to treatment, and there appears to be a very significant decrease in overdose deaths in those places. We live in a very different policy environment than many other settings, and so we've not been able to test this, but it seems unlikely that this is going to encourage drug use. And I would say, you know, we have to collect more data on this, and the only way we're going to be able to do that is to actually introduce some of these facilities. But one of the things that
what
we do
data,
know,
may I step in? What data is really missing here? What are the missing puzzle pieces in data?
So in the United States, we don't know how many people will use these facilities, given the potential criminal justice implications of going into and out of a safe consumption facility. There has to be agreement that we're not going to prosecute people who are going into these facilities. We need to collect data on, you know, whether drug use does increase or decrease in these places, and we won't know that until we have them. Mm. We need to know whether we see things like a reduction in the disposed of needles, you know, and syringes out in the community. We need to know whether there's going to be a reduction in the amount of public injecting that often goes on in high drug corridors in communities. And if we see those go down, we've learned something about community impact mm-hmm. Of these. And then we need to be collecting as much information as we can from those who use these resources to better understand what brought them in, so that we can use that learning to encourage more use of that safe consumption facility, where people are going to get exposed to opportunities for treatment and certainly cleaner drug use.
Lots of unanswered questions in this landscape. Sharon Larson is a substance abuse issues researcher, leads the Mainline Health Center for Population Health in the Philadelphia area. What do you think of letting people use drugs in a supervised environment? Have you visited a supervised drug use site in New York City or know about it? Would you support the model being replicated in your own community? Join in. Your questions, your thoughts on this, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Sharon Larson here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the crisis of drug overdose deaths and the role of overdose prevention centers, also called supervised injection facilities. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the Drug Policy Alliance, that's a nonprofit seeking to reduce the harms of drug use, there are 120 such centers operating in 10 countries worldwide and now New York City. What do you think about the idea of letting people use drugs in a supervised space? Do you think we need to decriminalize drug use? 800-642-1234 to join in. Sharon Larson is Associate Dean of Research at Thomas Jefferson University and a substance abuse and mental health researcher with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Sharon, what about staffing? Would a licensed nurse be allowed to work at a place where drugs are being injected? And how would that work with licensing requirements?
Great question, Kate. And I think this is one that has been considered over the course of this conversation. It appears that, although this will vary from state to state, it appears that the licensing standards simply prohibit healthcare professionals from administering these illegal drugs. And so it's an important distinction. Nurses will do what nurses do, that is, create a safe environment, recommend that people seek treatment when they're ready, and provide that oversight and be available if someone does have an overdose experience and needs resuscitation, needs naloxone, needs to be transported to the hospital. That's the purpose of having healthcare professionals present.
You talked about all these data gaps, but there have been sanctioned drug use sites in Europe and in Canada for years. What is different about how those facilities operate compared to what could be established here in the U.S.?
So we obviously have had a sort of regulatory barrier that it appears might be under consideration at this point in time. So that's one. The other is that I have to believe, and this is sort of opinion right now, that the lack of sort of a national health payer program probably makes a difference as well. Probably access to treatment once a substance user makes that transition from being there to inject and then transitioning to seeking treatment. We have a dearth of providers who can move people through recovery. And so I think all of those things kind of contribute to maybe barriers, and certainly none of them are barriers that can't be overcome, but we have to work forward on those.
Talking with Sharon Larson, who leads the Mainline Health Center for Population Health Research, as we look at overdose prevention centers as perhaps a tool to drive down opioid addiction. With your questions and thoughts, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Kimberly in Fox Lake. Hi, Kimberly. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. So, I mean, this seems like a really good idea. I just don't know. Even if the legislature gets on, I think there's just going to be too much community pushback to get something like this on. But the opioid addiction and overdosing seems like an insurmountable epidemic right now. Like, I don't know if there's any other solutions or just ways to try to work on this that have been considered as well. I don't know if you guys have looked into that at all.
Kimberly, that is a great, great question. You know, if a center isn't feasible, what is? And Sharon, what have you found with your research?
So our research hasn't specifically looked at that, but I can tell you that in the state of Pennsylvania, naloxone is now available to anyone who wants to carry it. So from the overdose perspective, every citizen in adult citizen, obviously, in Pennsylvania can go to a pharmacy and get naloxone to have available. And thus we have that capacity to at least revive someone who is experiencing an overdose. And I think that's a really important tool and one that our state government backed in a way that I think could be replicated across the nation. So that's one start. I think the other is that we can't fail to recognize the still stigmatized perspective that we hold on substance use. And we tend to sort of think in our nation, at least some of us do, that, you know, this is sort of a moral failing instead of a healthcare issue. And we need to begin moving beyond that and have more people accept that this is a health condition. Providers need to be talking with their patients about this. More providers need to have the waiver that allows them to prescribe substance use treatment alternatives like buprenorphine in order to, you know, we just need to make it more readily available.
So let's say a community, a city is open to an injection site and is really wanting to start the process to get it rolling. What would you say is a good way to start on this path for a city that really wants to look into this and perhaps make it possible?
Well, as a researcher, I don't know about the infrastructure of doing that. I do know that research has suggested that a failure to engage your community is, you know, the hallmark of failure to get these going. And so New York did this very well. I think they had good buy-in from most of the boroughs in New York City. And so your next speaker is probably going to be able to speak to that. I think in Philadelphia, we struggled a bit with engaging the community, finding the right locations. And let me just throw out one other thing. Remember that those who inject opioids often do this many times a day. And so I think figuring out where is the right location to be as readily available for those frequent uses will be an important part of this. And again, engaging the community and knowing that that's what's going on and then being supportive of that. And then finally, I think we have to begin by capturing the baseline data about individuals who inject drugs. We have to be able to characterize our communities, and then we have to watch those numbers as we begin to implement these kinds of facilities so that we know what's working and what isn't, and we can kind of tweak the model along the way.
Let's go to Joshua now in La Crosse. Joshua, hi, go ahead.
Hello, Kate. I was just calling to say, or I guess my opinion on it is, in the reality of things, safe consumption sites already exist in the United States in the form of bars. They are just, you know, much less regulated and don't come equipped with the resources that these facilities that are being discussed on your show would have, you know, medical professionals on site and resources to get help if you are seeking it.
Interesting parallel, Joshua. Thank you for that. Sharon, how do you see that?
Well, I don't disagree with Joshua. I think that there are places, and in fact, we know that there are unsanctioned safe consumption facilities that have been present in the United States for many years. The problem is they are unsanctioned. They are at risk on a daily basis in their operations. And we don't know what we don't know from that experience. So until we begin to gather that public health data that tells us how this is working, we're not going to be able to improve on the model and know whether it actually is reducing both use and overdose deaths.
Sharon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sharon Larson is Associate Dean of Research at Thomas Jefferson University. Stay with us for more on the opioid overdose crisis and the view from inside overdose prevention centers. We meet the director of the nation's first two authorized drug injection sites in New York City's East Harlem and Washington Heights neighborhoods. Should more sites open around the country in this epidemic? Do you worry about unintended consequences? 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. As drug overdose deaths top 1 million since the federal government started collecting data on this crisis more than two decades ago, we look at the impact of overdose prevention centers on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In December, New York City became the first in the nation to pilot sanctioned safe consumption sites. The Drug Policy Alliance has pushed for them, said they hope other states will follow New York's example. What questions do you have about how an overdose prevention center works? Would you want Wisconsin to follow New York's model? 800-642-1234. Sam Rivera is executive director of On Point NYC. It's a community healthcare organization operating the first sanctioned open-use drug use sites in America. Sam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
Good morning. Yes. Take us, if you will, inside your safe consumption sites. Tour us around, if you will.
Sure. I think the biggest thing that happens for people is, for those who didn't know us prior to opening the safe consumption center, people assume that when you open the door, you're walking into this room full of people just using drugs. We're more than that. I really appreciate the way you described us. We are a health center. We do provide an array of services for our participants. When you enter the actual space, there's a drop-in center, and you walk into that space, and then in the back of that initial space is where we have the safe consumption site. But on that first floor, we have a health hub, for a drug user health hub, for those who use drugs and need, and for many people, an introduction to health, to appropriate health care and not utilizing the ER as their health care. And then we have case management and holistic health services, which include sound therapy, acupuncture, massage therapy, an array of other services as well. But you want me to walk you through the actual room itself?
Yes, that would be great. Go ahead.
Sure. So you walk in the room. First of all, to get in the room is locked, and again, has his own staff separate from all the other staff. To enter the room, you first meet with someone. You talk about what you're going to use, how you're going to use it, how much. You go through an intake process. If you're already a participant, we still want to know how much and what you're using and how. We do that every time, even if you come in multiple times a day. And I heard the person before me talk about that, and that's key. So when you enter the room, we have eight, depending on which building, but we have multiple booths for people who are going to consume at a booth, and then we have smoke rooms as well.
Which drugs do your sites provide supervised injection oversight for?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's safe consumption, so any drug... Yeah. It's any drugs. It's not only injection. And I appreciate that, because many people still call them SIFs, you know, safe injection facilities. So it's any drug people bring with themselves to use. They can't use a drug for the first time with us. That's not allowed. But any drug they bring with them and they need the paraphernalia to use safely, we provide that, and we provide the safe space for them to use as well.
Sam, what happens when someone overdoses?
Yeah, this is, you know, very, very different. And I remember I always chuckle, because when we first opened, the only one who had experience was Kaylin C., our senior director of programs. She actually operated a couple in Canada. So she's the only one who really had experience. For many of us, for the rest of us, an overdose, we find an overdose as it's deep in it, you know, minutes into the overdose, sometimes too many minutes into the overdose. So we're used to seeing someone already, you know, in a really difficult state. In this case, we're addressing the overdose so early. Initially, staff would say, wait a minute, but there wasn't an overdose, you know, because we're documenting everything. And they would say, but there wasn't an overdose. And we learned from Kaylin, there was an overdose. Here's what happened. We are responding at the onset of the overdose. Mm. So it's very early. There's a process in place and there's a policy as to how we do it. We see someone nodding a little bit. Okay, we check in. Basically, once they're non-responsive, then we start with agitation, other avenues before we even use Narcan. And one of the most shocking things for people is the amount of times we're using Narcan, which is very, very low, something like less than 25% of the time, because there are other avenues, agitation, oxygen. We are, for what I know, one, if not the only one who uses oxygen to work with our people when they're overdosing. The other thing we do is we use what we call tip back. So we use 0.5 milligram intramuscular naloxone. We don't use the 4 milligram. We have them available, but for those who do this work and medical professionals will know that when you use the 4 milligrams in someone's nostril, it's actually too much for most people. Hmm. Now the critics will say, but you're saving someone's life. Yes, I totally agree. Totally. I'm not telling anyone not to use it. If you have the benefit that we have to be in that room and use 0.5 intramuscular, then what you're doing is removing enough of the opioid from the brain so that the person is revived and is now present and conscious again.
Sounds like you don't have to reach for the last resort option when you're right there, steps away and monitoring it.
Yes, exactly. They're in the room, in your same space, we monitor. And once you start early, you're really interrupting that process, which is really, you know, people have a hard time hearing this, but it's beautiful because we're keeping people alive. Mm. And that's really what we're there for, is to make sure people stay alive. They're not acquiring or sharing or spreading any diseases while they're doing this, you know, HIV, hepatitis, et cetera. So that's really the overall goal initially, to keep people with us. And then all of the other things that many people like to talk about, like potential treatment and detox, et cetera, are obviously available when, and this is important, when the individual is available, not when we're available, when the individual is ready, not when we're ready. It's really their life and it's their time. And, you know, when they're ready, we're ready.
Sam Rivera with us, Executive Director of OnPoint NYC. This is a community healthcare organization operating the first sanctioned drug consumption sites in the country. You can join in. Have you or a loved one overdosed on drugs? Tell us about your experience and what helped you through it. 800-642-1234. Sam, I'm wondering how your sites have partnered or not, or what that relationship looks like with law enforcement, local law enforcement and policing. How does that work?
It's been, oh my God, I get excited because it's been a beautiful relationship. Yes. Mm-hmm. I am saying to anyone out there who's used drugs, who has participated in harm reduction, that we have a beautiful, loving, supportive relationship with the NYPD, something we didn't really have before in this way. We fought for that. When we were opening, we kept pushing, you know, Kaylin and I kept pushing the city and the health department to make sure that NYPD was at the table. This is a big deal, right? It could potentially lead to arrest, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And where we ended up is when we opened, there were police present and people were like, wait, what's going on? Hmm. But the police were there to provide safety for us, our staff, for potential protesters and media. So that in itself is just a really great experience to have. We have an ongoing relationship with both precincts in the areas we're located. We go and we speak at their roll calls. They want us to do more. They visit constantly to make sure everything's okay. So that relationship is key. It's extremely important. And one of the biggest things we see is when they come in and visit, even the police officers who initially were in support of what we were doing, when they come in and visit, they are absolutely blown away by what they see on the inside. I mean, two weeks ago, we had two of the officers come in, and one was basically crying. Like, he couldn't believe what happened on the inside because of the perception. And even those who support, unless you actually see it, it's a very different experience in your mind and what you actually see in person.
We know there are gaps in data and what these centers are able to show for what they're doing. Can you explain what you're tracking, what you've seen in your numbers, and what that's revealing in these early months?
Yeah, no, this is when I wish I was on video because my smile is from ear to ear. you know, we have, we're over 900 unique participants in just a few months. I mean, that's huge in a city that had 2,000 overdoses, averages 2,000 overdoses. We're coming up on 12,000 utilizations. We're coming up very soon on 200 overdose reversals. And you know, the thing I tell people when they look at the 200, at this point, 190, in the 190s of overdose reversals, are one of the things I really see. And I know because I go in the room, I'm in the room, I see the people, the beautiful people, is that we're counting those reversals, but we are also supporting people on using safely, on using appropriately with wound care, creating a safe space for them. One of the things people don't realize is when users are using in the street and they're hiding in the alley or they're hiding it somewhere or they use a bathroom, they're often also exposed to violence. Because people don't like them and people attack them. And if they use in someone's restroom, they are exposed to violence. So in addition to reversing the actual onset of an overdose, we are keeping many more people alive, healthy, and well simply by existing, simply by creating the safe space for them to come in, to have a meal, to take a shower, to wash their clothes, to really feel human again. And the biggest thing I see is we're working with some of the most beautiful people who have been dehumanized, who are treated as disposable people. And I invite anyone to come in and see how beautiful they are. And I'll say this to wrap that up. How many friends many of us have who were these people? Take a step back and remember many, many people we know were these folks. And many of them are productive members of society, working, doing so many beautiful things to make this country who we are and other countries who we are.
Let's pause right there with Sam Rivera, leads On Point NYC, as we discuss the role of overdose prevention centers in combating the opioid crisis in our nation. Have you visited a supervised drug use site in New York City, another country? What was that like? Do you think we should create spaces like this in Wisconsin? Still time to talk, to think about it. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're learning about sanctioned safe spaces for people to consume drugs under supervision of trained staff and these first-in-the-nation sites in New York City. Every community in Wisconsin and beyond is touched by opioid overdose deaths. The CDC says 136 people die from an opioid overdose every day. Every single day. Is there a place for overdose prevention centers? What are your solutions to this crisis? 800-642-1234. Sam Rivera is Executive Director of On Point NYC and with us for about 9 more minutes. Sam, I found it interesting that some of your staffers at your sites are in recovery programs themselves, and I'm wondering what effect does that have on users who come in?
Well, even, you know, myself, I'm a person with lived experience. I made mistakes in my life. what folks who bring in with lived experience, what they do, what they offer the participant is a potential insight to their future. Mm. It's to look at us and say, that could be me. I tell people, I've been here, not in the drug use, but I'm a person who have lived experience and I was in prison. And I tell people, if I can turn my life around, anybody can. Mm. I am you, I just got here before you. So having folks, in addition to that, having folks who actually use drugs, injected drugs, use all forms of consumption in the same way people are using in the room, allows them to see what their future could be like. You know, one of the misconceptions, the biggest misconception, is that we're providing this, and people will say, well, just send them to treatment. I want to be very clear. Every one of our participants, every one of them has tried detox and treatment often multiple times. Now, that said, I'm not saying it won't work. It just didn't work that time. So if we keep them alive, the way we keep them alive will allow them to try again, if and when they're ready. So our role is to have that be in that position until they're ready. When someone says they're ready, we connect them literally within minutes. We go into action and connect them. So yeah, having staff with lived experience who are in the room, folks in recovery, folks who are in all stages of recovery, is huge and really impactful for the participant.
And the East Harlem site is also staffed by trained medical personnel. Your other site, I understand, is operated by peers. Can you contrast that, or is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I will say this, though. Every staff member at both sites are trained to respond in the same way an RN would. Uh-huh. So let's start from that place, right? So every one of us, everyone, I mean everyone, if you're in our HR department, if you're part of our maintenance staff, everyone who works for us, especially those in the room, obviously. So yeah, in our East Harlem site, we have medical professionals, nurses, and doctors at the ready. And then our Washington Heights site is mostly run by peers, folks who might still be active in the moment, and are both working for us and sometimes participants as well.
What does success look like? How will you measure whether OnPoint is successful or not?
So far we're successful. I do celebrate what we've achieved so far. And it's important for me to do that, not for me, but for the participants and our staff. I have the most amazing staff in the world, committed to this work in a way that just, it's immeasurable. It's immeasurable. Like, we cannot even begin to tell you how amazing they are. So, and success for us is to also witness other communities who need these, let's use the word need, who need safe consumption sites to then open their own. And again, to maintain the numbers we are reaching now, to create these beautiful relationships we have with individuals in the room who normally hide their use, who feel a part of a community, who are called by their name for the first time, not, hey, you junkie or whatever. And so, yeah, success would be for the United States to also recognize that this is a health intervention that saves lives and keeps people alive and allow us to be funded in the healthiest way. Not in contrast with anything else, but in addition to the healthcare system we have today.
I'm thinking about the density of where you live and the wide open rural spaces that are so much of what Wisconsin is. Do you think this model could be replicated in rural areas?
Model could be replicated anywhere. The main thing is need. Yes, definitely. Differently. You know, one of the things that we're doing, Kaylin and I and the team are doing, is asking, it's telling folks, one is come visit and then bring us in. Allow us to come in and support you and walk you through the process. It is not just about having a space and opening, having a desire to save people and be an amazing harm reductionist, some of the most amazing people on this planet. It's more than that, and the structure around it. So my role oftentimes in talking to folks who want to open and other organizations who want to open is the infrastructure piece, the infrastructure. How do you open? Mm-hmm. How do you fund it? What are the laws? You know, how do you do it legally within your organization so that you don't hurt other parts of the organization if something were to go wrong? There's a lot that goes into opening But yeah, my answer, short answer is yes. If the need is present, please open, and you can open them anywhere.
You've said a couple of times the words harm reduction, and I just want to spend a moment there. Harm reduction in substance use treatment is really aimed at decreasing the negative consequences of substance use. And I'm wondering, how do you define, how do you see harm reduction from your vantage point in the work you do?
From my vantage point, it's, as I'm looking into the rooms. From my vantage point, is engaging with really people who are, you know, we know that when people use drugs, they're self-medicating pain, they're self-medicating mental health condition, they're self-medicating traumatic experiences they had. They don't just wake up and want to use drugs. They're self-medicating many experiences in their lives, bad experiences in their lives. So for me, from my vantage point, harm reduction is a life-saving tool that just allows people, like I meet so many people, I receive so many emails and texts and calls from people thanking us, not just me, every harm reductionist in this world, thanking us for being there so that they're here now. If we weren't here, if harm reduction wasn't present, 100,000 would be 200,000 or 300,000. I guarantee you, there are people doing providing harm reduction services who are not highlighted as we are now because we have safe consumption sites. But there are people out there saving lives every day across this country and across this world. Mm. So that's for me. That's what it is. Harm reduction is a life-saving, amazing, beautiful, loving health intervention. That's from my vantage point.
Your sites are sanctioned, but for how long do you think sites will have to operate underground in our country? Because there are sites that are operating underground.
There are many, and it's survival, right? And one of the things I love about humans is we will do everything possible to stay alive. We will do everything possible to keep our fellow man and woman alive. Mm. I think it's really about the next step in the positive way. I don't want to discuss the potential of closing. I want to discuss the potential for Rahul Gupta, the head of ONDCP, for Joe Biden, the president of the United States, and et cetera, to step up, get rid of the crack house statute, change it, make this a legal health intervention. We know it's a health intervention. It's a successful, proven health intervention around this world. Let's make it legal. Mm-hmm. Allow us to be funded. Allow us to operate just like a medical service operates.
Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Sam Rivera, Executive Director of OnPoint NYC. Earlier, we talked with Sharon Larson, Associate Dean of Research at Thomas Jefferson University. The National Helpline is free. It's confidential 24/7. That number, 1-800-662-HELP. That's 800-662-4357. That helpline is operated by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.